Welcome to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy with Brent Lee and Neil Sanders. This is the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. On the 22nd of May, 2017, Salman Abedi detonated a bomb in the foyer of the Manchester Arena at the end of an Ariana Grande concert, killing 22 people and injuring hundreds more. A conspiracy theory claiming that this bombing was hoaxed and everyone involved was a crisis actor soon became a dominant narrative in the conspirasphere. One of the main proponents of this theory is Richard D. Hall. Over the course of this series, we will be examining the claims made by Richard D. Hall, as told in his book and documentary, Night of the Bang. Please be aware, this series will be examining a deadly bombing, and we will be discussing details of death and injury. Listener discretion is advised. This is part one.
Right, I guess we should start right here and just like, let's pull the trigger on this one because we have got our very first co-conspirator guest something.
Yeah, co-conspirator. I like that.
Please, Joel Hill, introduce yourself.
Hey guys, it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm the co-host of the Condition Release Program podcast all the way down in Australia where the weather is better, but the conspiracy theorists are... Actually, our conspiracy theorists are probably better. You guys are really fucked up guys. There's a guy named Aaron something with sort of neck tats or something, and I've seen a few of these things. And you got Posey Parker. Fuck Posey Parker. So, yeah, no, I don't in any way, shape or form envy your position as the... The English are very good at being the premier miserable country in the world. I take that back. I love you all.
It's true. It's true. In fact, we take pride in it. We queued up a long time to get that, and now we're going to take advantage of it.
Well, look, I can't say that I don't love a good queue, so I have inherited a lot of traits from you guys. Colonization really did work. Look, it's really good because I just love coming on here and hearing the research. This is my... One of my favorite podcasts. It used to probably be Killer Anonymous. I think you guys have basically pipped them. Knowledge Fight, if they took a lot of the between words out, I also rate. But I'd say you guys are probably my top rotation. So being a part of the crew is an absolute honor. And your research is second to none. I wish I was this good. You guys did the WF episode before I did mine, and it made me sort of cry inside because I'm like, I'm still going to do the episode, but it's not going to be as good as message. This. Well, that's how we first met, I think, because that's how I stumbled upon you guys because I was looking for something to look and just get some things. And I'm like, shit, this is good. Fuck, I can't steal it. I'm just going to, okay.
I think you said in all due respect, fuck you guys.
That sounds like me. But yeah, I'm looking forward to some more collaborations and just hanging out and basically just being a passenger for the ride because you guys bend my brains in ways that very few do. I really appreciate your work and I'm glad you guys have jumped into the fray because we need more people like you guys, just smart, level-headed, good research, funny, people doing podcasts and other media to basically counteract these absurd counter-narratives that are taking over the Western world and fucking giving people brain worms.
Thank you. Mm. And thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
Right. So tonight is a bit of a special one really, isn't it? Because we've got a kind of personal connection to it. The conspiracy theory is Richard D. Hall's film and book, The Night of the Bang. And, this is a bit of a strange one because Richard D. Hall is a conspiracy theorist from the UK who's got his own channel and his own website called richplanet.com or richplanet.net, actually. And he's got his start in things like UFOs. So he was very interested in crop circles, alien sightings, UFOs, cattle mutilation, and stuff like that. Now, here's a strange thing. I know Richard. In fact, up until recently, I've considered him a friend. I still consider him a friend. Whether he considers me a friend is a completely other conversation. But I got my start with him. It was him that encouraged me to write books about mind control and appear on his show. I've been on his show a few times. I do know the guy. He's done quite a lot of sort of more controversial films, stuff about Madeleine McCann and the death of MP Joe Cox. I did a film about Jill Dando as well. That's, they are of varying quality and varying levels of plausibility, basically. But he's got very, very sort of broad concept. Now, what's really interesting is that when Sandy Hook came out, and then following that, the death of Lee Rigby, the alternative media jumped on both of those events and said, these are fakes. These are hoaxes. Nobody's died in these events. They're elaborate pieces of street theater. And at the time, I vividly remember chatting with Richard at one of his live shows and saying, this is nonsense. I don't buy any of this. I think it's a silly concept. I don't see how it'd work. And at the time, Richard absolutely 100% agreed with me. Like, at the time, he was trying to move more towards sort of true crime rather than conspiratorial stuff. And he thought that the whole crisis actor concept, which is the idea that all the people who supposedly die are actors and nobody really dies, and the whole thing is basically some sort of, as I said before, elaborate street theater. But essentially what happened was, there's a program called that he did on his show called All Our Terror Attacks Are Fake or something like that, with Nick Colostrum in it. And you could actually watch through the episode, Nick persuading Richard that this is a viable technique. And very shortly after that, he started looking into other events, culminating in the Manchester Arena bombing. Now, the Manchester Arena bombing, it happened on the 22nd of May, 2017. And this was following a concert by singer Ariana Grande. 22-year-old Salman Abedi walked into the foyer of the Manchester Arena, which is sometimes called the City Room. And he had a homemade TATP bomb that was inside a rucksack that also contained 30 kilograms of nuts and bolts. He detonated this bomb at 10:31 as all the concertgoers were actually leaving. 22 people killed, 23 including Abedi. Initially, 119 people were reported injured, but this rose to eventually a final count of 1,017 people sustaining injuries, 239 of which were physical. The youngest victim who died was a girl called Safi Roussos, and she was sadly only 8 years old. So it was a horrific event that sort of became very much ingrained into the minds of the public all over the world, specifically in the UK. However, Richard's theory that he's explored in a film called The Night of the Bang and a book called The Night of the Bang is that the entire thing was a fake event. He doesn't believe that anybody died. He doesn't believe that an actual bomb went off at the arena. He thinks that the entire thing was an elaborate hoax that was orchestrated by the intelligence agencies with the use of some actors, some real people that have basically been offered a new life somewhere or whatever. But essentially everybody involved is playing a part, pretending that a terrorist attack happened. But in Richard's theory, none of this actually happened. Now, he released this film in 2020, along with a book of the same name. Now, interestingly, in 2022, he's being sued by survivors of the bombing campaign. Specifically, Martin Hibbert is one of the people that's pushing this. And he's taken an interesting defense on this, rather than apologize or anything like that. What he's decided his defense is going to be is, yes, but my theory's right. Nobody died on the night. He's even gone so far as to suggest that Martin Hibbert, who is the person who's bringing the lawsuit against him, isn't the person that he says he is. And he's asking him to prove this in court. Now, this was kind of connected to a BBC Panorama program, which I was involved in and Brent was involved in. We'll talk a little bit about it later because I don't want to spoilers or anything like that. But essentially, this sort of alerted him to this lawsuit. And his defense, particularly his defense against Mariana Spring, who's the reporter that actually sort of doorsteps him about this, is, have you actually read my evidence? Have you read the book? Have you looked at the film? And to be fair to Richard, it's a massive book. It's a huge investigation. There's like 450 odd pages. I don't think that Mariana Spring had read the book, or not entirely. I think she was aware of his theory, but I don't think that she'd actually sort of got into the minutia. And so to be fair to Richard, it hasn't been appraised like that. But there's obviously enough evidence in Richard's perspective for him to build a narrative around it. Now, I will say right from the off that basically when this came about, who is portrayed, or he's been portrayed in the UK media as the UK's Alex Jones. And this is specifically because Alex Jones said that Sandy Hook was fake and he was later sued by the parents. And I was interviewed by The Telegraph, actually, which is a mainstream broadsheet newspaper in the UK, specifically about this because I know Richard. The question that they asked me was, do you think that Richard is the UK's Alex Jones? And I said, no, I don't think he is at all. And the distinction that I made was that Alex Jones is a grifter and a charlatan who knows that he's lying and doesn't care. He just wants to sell something to the audience. The distinction with Richard is that Richard believes this, and he believes that he's doing a good thing. He believes that he's uncovered a massive, massive fraud that's been perpetuated against the general public, and that he's actually doing a service to the world through this. Whether you believe him, whether you think he's right or wrong, we don't know. We'll look at the evidence shortly. But that is the distinction. Alex Jones doesn't give a shit. Alex Jones is just a greasy car salesman that wants money. Richard isn't necessarily interested in the money aspect of it. Potentially the fame. We all want to get recognition for our work. But Richard thinks of himself as a sort of Woodward and Bernstein. Whereas Alex Jones is a huckster. He's just an absolute complete huckster. And so that is the distinction. So let's get straight into it.
Before we do that.
Yeah.
Can we discuss where we were at the time that this attack happened?
Oh, sorry, yeah.
What we felt about it at the time, because obviously
yeah,
I was kind of on my way out, but not completely on my way out.
Yeah, in 2017.
Okay.
You know, and I'd like to get a tap on basically what you guys heard.
I actually was in Manchester at the arena once.
Oh, yeah.
To see 90 Styles in 2009.
Oh, marvellous, yeah.
And I went backstage, which was pretty cool.
Oh, wow. Did they do the thing that they did in the Marilyn Manson autobiography?
Not quite, no. It was very...
Oh, good. Oh, thank God for that.
Very relaxed, but I did play Scissors Paper Rock with Trent Reznor and...
oh, sick.
He won and he was real cunt about it.
Oh, wow. Oh, marvellous.
Yes. But anyway, yeah, we'll kick on. So when it comes down to where we were, because I'm guessing this is getting edited out anyway, is that I wasn't really anywhere. I was in Australia and I heard of it as being a news story. And to be honest, it didn't register here like it did there.
No, fair enough. I mean, that's understandable.
It was a news story.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a false flag. I was still in that sort of mind frame of everything that happens, there's probably another explanation for it. If I'm brutally honest, I didn't look into it too much because it wasn't really sort of my area. At the time as well, basically, because we were coming off the back of, say, 9/11, 7/7, and stuff like that, any time where a Muslim bloke happened to blow themselves up, there was always an air of suspicion of like, oh, yeah, that's convenient, isn't it?
Yes.
Ongoing narrative.
Totally.
Like, because obviously, you know, there was certain things going off in the Middle East, Libya later, like, you know, the Iraq war and latterly Syria and stuff like that as well, where basically this, you could be forgiven for thinking that the ideas of Al-Qaeda and later ISIS were sometimes used as a convenient bogeyman or scapegoat to justify foreign policy, essentially. Now, whether that was the case, don't know. We would need to go back and examine each bit over and over.
It's very easy to link a false flag to these things because there's always money involved in military hardware and expenditure and things like that. So it's a building block. It's a self-building Lego system. It's once you have an attack, you can immediately say, okay, Muslim guy, cool. Here's the stepping stones toward my theory. I'm done. You don't even need to think about it. It builds itself. It's a real simple one.
What did you think at the time, Brent?
Instantly, I was like, yeah, of course, that's going to be a false flag.
Yeah.
I didn't subscribe to hoaxes or crisis actors, none of that type of stuff. I always thought it was kind of garbage. But the minute it happened, I just thought, okay, watch, there's going to be some sort of intelligence link or something like that. I felt like, you know, I don't even need to look into it.
Yeah.
I already know it's going to be that because the precedent has been set. Like, I've gone into 7/7. I did that like so much. Like, of course this is going to be one. Like,
when the night of the ban came out in 2020, did you see it?
No. Didn't even bother. But 2020, though, I was out. I wasn't in it anymore. I wasn't believing any of this stuff anymore. I was kind of trying to figure out where I had gone wrong.
About that time was an interesting time for me because I'd just been started working with, I think I'd just started working with David Icke on Iconic at that point. Yeah, that was short-lived for reasons that we'll, dis- that we'll discuss on a later show.
Yes, when you get a lawyer.
But yeah, when the film came out, I remember thinking I wasn't a fan of the crisis actor thing. And I remember watching certain bits in the film and going, oh, what are you doing, Richard? Oh dear, what are you doing? And if I'm being honest, I thought at the time that he was trying to sort of kind of make a name for himself, in as much as certain other people, Stephen Molyneux, Ian Crane, Ben Allen Jones, various people that we know within the sort of UK thing, had been in the newspaper with some sort of talk about their theories. Now, obviously, they were ridiculed, but at the time, that was sort of massive exposure. And also at the time, Alex Jones was coasting along, doing his Sandy Hook thing with absolutely zero consequence for what he was saying.
Yeah.
So I thought at the time that Richard had purposely chosen a quite controversial topic in order to make waves. Now, I still believe that he believed what he said, but I thought that this is one of the things where you could have, you knew there was going to be a backlash. And I think he sort of, to a degree, relished that. But I also do remember watching the film, and there were certain things in it that I went, oh, I can't explain that. This is a, you know, he's not done this willy-nilly. He's not done this off a whim. He's constructed a narrative with evidence. Whether you think that evidence is particularly strong, in retrospect, whether that evidence is correct, we're about to find out. But it's important to say at the time, although I didn't like the film, there were certain bits of it that were uncomfortable with me because I couldn't explain them.
Well, that's Brandolini's law, which is that it is, you know, infinitely harder to disprove bullshit than it is to spout it. And spouting convincing bullshit is, to some people, quite natural. Alex Jones being a huckster, sure, but he spouts bullshit convincingly, very rapid fire. Off the top of his head, he'll just make shit up. He'll just do it so confidently and so no worries. You can tell a fraud by their lack of confidence, and you can't tell a fraud when they truly are a huckster like that.
Yeah.
In a situation like that, Brandolini's law, it basically, Brandolini's law lives under my bed, because it is just such a part of my life where whenever I see bullshit and I instantly think, oh, I've got to debunk this, I realize, no, I don't. It's going to take me a long time. And what it's going to do is it's going to lead me to the next piece of bullshit, which I also can't debunk, while they just spout these things out like machine gun fire. So yeah, it's understandable to think things are compelling. And it's very difficult to debunk them. So you start thinking, shit, well, if I can't prove this wrong, then maybe it's right. You cannot disprove a negative. You cannot disprove a lie. It doesn't work. And that's the trap. And they're very fucking good at making that trap work. You know, that sticks.
I think that's what sets us apart. You know, that's what sets us apart. That's what gives us that edge, because we believed it. We know the talking points. We know where you're going. Like recently, obviously, when I did the George Galloway thing, I knew what he was going to say.
He's doing it. Yeah.
The instant he mentions one topic, I know the talking points he's going to do.
Northwood was a strange place to go, though. I did not expect that. I'm like, what? Niche.
This is why I did this. Like, I was watching Vosh and Destiny like a few years back. Two political streamers.
Yeah.
And in the same week, they were both asked, like, who would you never debate? And both of them said a conspiracy theorist, because I couldn't keep up with the Gish Gallop.
Yeah.
And both of them saying that in the week really struck me. And I was like, you know what? I think I could do that.
Yeah.
I could actually keep up with it.
You could, yeah.
And that's why I eventually settled on, like, let's make some YouTube videos.
Yeah.
I can go there first and start seeing how, like, I can approach the subject. And eventually, it obviously turns into what we are today.
Yeah.
But it's because I thought, you know what, I can keep up with it. And then I come across Neil, and like, we both are in that same boat. We can keep up with this. Let's do this.
Yeah. Like the Northwood thing, I think, was that thing of saying, I know something you don't because I'm smarter than you. And you just went, oh, no, I'm across the brief. Don't worry.
Yeah.
And it ruined the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, the entire thing was thrown by that. You know, he could have done a whole bunch of tropes. There's all sorts of things they love to refer to that sound so niche, but at the end of the day, they're standard great shit, you know? And some of them are true, and that's fine, but some of them aren't, and that's fine as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a very good spot. If no one's actually watched that video,
do watch it. Yeah.
Click it. It's worth it. It's worth the time. On a million levels. I really enjoyed it. If anything, just to see him squirm. I liked it. It was definitely worth a click.
We're going to do a show about George Galloway as well. So
Like,
look out for that.
Get lawyers.
Right, so Rich Planet, Night of the Bang. And he makes it clear as well that basically from the start with the film that he's had some help from some bloke called UK Critical Thinker. It's not like a collaboration. Rich has been done the main sort of a thing, but he's seen UK Critical Thinker's work and gone, oh, I agree with that bit. I agree with that bit. I agree with that bit.
Mm-hmm.
So the film opens up with an advertisement for Strategic Operations, right? And Strategic Operations is a crisis actor-led training company that recreates battle and public safety training events. And there's a voiceover that says,
our heritage is unique. One of the largest independent television and movie studios in America in 2002 created Strategic Operations and changed the face of training, simulation, and education. Strategic Operations introduced the magic of Hollywood to live military and public safety training, transforming sterile training environments into dynamic recreations of any real-world situation that could be imagined. TV and movie special effects artists create realistic battlefield effects, including rocket-propelled grenades, mines, and explosions from improvised explosive devices. Smoke, sound, and smell add the highest level of realism safely to simulate the fog of war. It becomes stress inoculation. Medical products like the Cut Suit, a human-worn surgical simulator, the 6-in-1 part task trainer, and the simulated wounds kit, to name just a few, have introduced a new level of hyper-realism to medical simulation, training, and education. Civilian trauma such as active shooter scenarios, industrial accidents, car crashes, collapsed buildings, and mass casualty scenarios can be replicated from the point of injury through the continuum of care. Ambulances can transport the injured to the fully equipped emergency department and two operating rooms. Strategic Operations is changing the world of simulation, training, and education with innovative ideas, services, and products. The results have been dramatic and are best described by those who go in harm's way, better prepared because of hyper-realistic training, simulation, and education.
And then we see shots of the Manchester Arena. What this is, Strategic Operations, is what it says. It's fake wounds. It's Hollywood special effects. It's where they train soldiers and policemen and ambulance people and stuff like that. And to add a degree of realism, sometimes they'll even use things like amputees who'll sort of dress up their arm, leg or whatever to make it look like it's a fresh wound. And it's one of these things where it's used, as it says, to inoculate people to the shock of things. And it's a real thing.
Yep.
I went and looked at this space, Strategic Operations. It's got a website still. It is definitely a thing. Now, it then cuts to conspiracy theorist Dave McGowan. Now, Dave McGowan, some people might know because he's written a couple of books. There's one on Laurel Canyon, which is surprisingly interesting, talking about all the sort of military connections to all the sort of famous rock stars like Jim Morrison's dad.
Yep, Frank Zappa.
Yeah, Frank Zappa's dad worked at Edgewood Arsenal, stuff like that. He even goes through the sort of punk revolution and shows that the members of the Police, Miles Copeland,
Brent Lee.
They're all connected to the CIA or have various sort of connections to Central Intelligence Agency. Again, compelling book, very interesting. He did another one about serial killers as well. And the name escapes me on that as well at the minute, but the sort of connection between mind control and potential serial killers. Again, fascinating book, really, really good. Latterly, he got into the moon landing was fake.
Mm-hmm.
A bizarre thing about how the Lincoln assassination wasn't quite the way that it was. But his big thing that sort of got him loads of popularity was that Dave McGowan thought that the Boston bombing was fake.
Yeah.
By which, okay. That basically he thought that no one died. They're all actors. The bloke that got his legs blown off was an amputee and it was all faked.
Strong.
That's and Richard says this at the start of his book as well. He says, because of the Boston bombing, we know that governments around the world perpetuate these hoaxes. And he's taken that from the work of Dave McGowan. And Dave McGowan says in the film,
one of the bridges that people have to get over to process this information is recognizing that it's not a conspiracy theory to say that the government employs crisis actors to, conduct these mass casualty simulations. It's a fact. It's an established fact that they do it. So, you know, it's not as bizarre as it sounds once you realize that the government has been doing this for a very long time. They just did one here just a few weeks ago, written up in the LA Times at the Burbank Airport. Airports are one of the most common places where they stage these. And there were pictures in the LA Times of the crisis actors. And they acknowledged that, you know, they were using Hollywood people to, you know, makeup people and special effects to stage these very realistic looking wounds.
And that's why he's included Dave McGowan, because Dave McGowan is a massive proponent of the theory. He's dead now, actually, but was a massive proponent of the theory that the Boston bombing never happened. And similar to the narrative that Richard's going to furnish about the Manchester thing, they were blaming these Patsy Muslims, and it was all about sort of progressing this idea that there's a problem with radical Islamic terrorism. So Richard goes on to explain the official narrative.
The Manchester Arena bombing was an alleged suicide bomb attack, which media reports claimed killed 22 people and a suicide bomber and injured over 100. The numbers vary on the amount of people allegedly injured. According to witnesses, the event started with a loud bang at 10:31 p.m. located inside the arena foyer, or the booking office, sometimes referred to as the City Suite. The foyer building is a large enclosed area just outside the main arena and adjoins onto a raised walkway which leads to the Manchester Victoria train station.
He then goes on to say,
many witnesses inside the arena reported hearing two bangs. The official Kerslake report and most media reports only mention one explosion. People have postulated that one of the two bangs was played over the arena's PA system. It is clear from witness accounts that one of the bangs did originate from something that was situated inside the arena foyer. The foyer is comprehensively covered by CCTV cameras, but footage from these cameras which would prove what happened has not been released. And this is just one reason why there is contention about what may have happened.
And to be fair, that's kind of true. I mean, like, you know, the actual sort of footage from the foyer has been limited. Like, certainly nobody's actually seen the point of the explosion. And Richard goes on to say that they don't necessarily need to release videos of any carnage.
They don't necessarily need to release video of any carnage. Just a sequence showing who was in the foyer and where they were situated immediately before the alleged explosion would go some way to establish whether what they have told us is true.
Any questions?
Was there a real bomb? Did people get injured at the arena? And did people die at the arena?
And Rich's contention is no. To all of those things, there was no bomb, nobody got injured, and nobody actually died. And then a title card comes up and it says, why the official narrative is impossible. So, you know, bold. but this is where he's about to stake his case, essentially.
Okay.
He also says,
there are no publicly available photographs that I have been able to find taken by concertgoers which show any of the deceased victims taken after the bang, either dead or alive, and situated in or immediately outside the arena.
Which is, you know, again, there has been limited sort of photographs that have been released. There's two sort of main bits of footage. There's the one main photo that lots of people might have seen, which shows a ShowSec employee kneeling down, a trail of blood coming sort of down towards the thing, and then sort of loads of carnage in the background. And then there's a video that shows the same scene, and it pans from right to left, and it shows a lady with blood trickling down her right thigh walking across the screen.
Yep, I've seen this, yeah.
That was taken by a bloke called John Barr, I think was his name. I may have got that wrong, but it was taken by a person called Barr. Oh, I've got it written down here. Who knew? yeah.
Do the take again.
So, yeah, so the video footage is taken by a gentleman called John Barr. And John Barr, it's not entirely clear who he was. I don't think he was a concert goer. He actually was just sort of passing by. So be fair, neither of those videos, of those bits of media, fit the criteria that Richard is on about.
Okay.
So fair enough, but perhaps he's actually got a point there.
Sometimes it's very difficult to reach for your phone when human tragedy strikes.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
He makes the point in the book that he says, I was driving home recently and there was an accident on the other side and literally everybody that you saw driving past, you got their phone out and was filming it. And to a degree, we do live in the sort of times where,
yeah,
you know, there's that meme, what would happen if the Titanic happened today? Everyone taking selfies.
It goes down.
So yeah, that might be a fair point. Like the absence of evidence could be an indication that there's something fishy going on there.
If I had like a piece of shrapnel in my thigh,
well,
I would be getting my phone out. At the same time, I'm also not an Ariana Grande attendee. Maybe some of these, you know, these characters, maybe they're a bit more Snapchat than I am. I don't know. Yeah. Like it's hard to put out. But I think it's interesting the fact that that was actually covered in, as you said, in the text, basically saying, well, I had an experience recently that reflected something differently. So he's thought of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's thought of it and he's doubled down on that.
Yeah, no, totally. And as I said, that is a fair point. We live in a scenario where, like, I mean, God knows, when was the last time you went to a concert and it wasn't just full of people just holding their phones up, not watching the concert?
Yeah, Tool and Perfect Circle. They'll kick you out if you have your phone out.
Oh, will they?
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's the best thing ever. You can't see it. Yeah. I went to a Nine Inch Nails concert where it was being clearly filmed by professional crane operators and there was a sea of camera phones. And I just thought, you fucking, do you not see there is a giant camera above your head? It's going to be on YouTube in like a day. Like just stop. Anyway.
Right. So somebody who was actually injured at the arena was a lady called Jenny Brewster. And she says that basically she was turned away from the foyer by Shosek. Shosek are the security guards that work at the thing. They're often students. I did it once when I was a student. Like basically you point people in this way and you get to see some of the concerts for free. So that's why you do it. They're not professional security guards often. Some are, but some, you know, do it as a career. Most of them are just students that live close to it, basically. Anyway, so Jenny Brewster says,
and there was a row of stewards stood in a line stopping us getting through, but they were very friendly and they said, this isn't your best way, girls. Your best turning round. You can get to your car parks that way. As I turn round, boom, one loud noise.
And there's also a girl called Freya who mentions being held back by security.
Everyone was waiting to be let out to walk down to the foyer area. And while we were waiting, no one would let us pass. And all of a sudden, we had like a massive explosion.
What Richard's implying here is that there might have been a degree of foreknowledge by some of the staff and that they were moving people away from the foyer area where this bomb, in inverted commas, was going to go off. And he's implying that the reason that they would want to keep people away from that is because the more people you have there, the more people might realize that this is elaborate street theater and not a real event. Richard says that the Kerslake report actually states the opposite. Within the first few minutes after the explosion, the duty manager instructed Shosek stewards in the arena to close the aisles nearest to the foyer exit and for stewards on the concourse to position themselves to divert concert goers in order as far as possible to avoid the public having to witness scenes in the foyer. So basically what the Kerslake report said was that this is accurate, essentially. They were stopping people from going into the foyer. And so these witnesses might be correct. And Richard, again, he's implying very heavily that this is to control that area. Not from this perspective of because it's a casualty event.
Yeah.
But from the perspective of because they're about to lay out their 10 bomb.
It's what you would do, though. You're trying to divert people from turning up because you don't want to interrupt the scene. I mean, you know, you got the director there. You got the stage actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is the point. You know, if anybody was to stumble across it, all of a sudden that's the entire plot gone, isn't it?
Or it just makes it really tricky because you've got to kill them.
Well, this is the thing. But what Richard suggests is because of his knowledge of this, that everybody that was supposedly in the foyer, that's all the people that took the footage, that's the three paramedics that attended, that's the police, that's the Shosek, that's everybody that died and everybody that was injured, they were all in on it. Okay, now, there was about 14,000 people at the concert. They're not in on it. There's a core group of people, about 100 or so, and they are in on it.
From a company like you mentioned, which do exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're paid to do this. It's interesting. It's interesting. It's really interesting.
But here's the thing. These people aren't necessarily crisis actors in the sense that they work for strategic operations or anything. They're crisis actors in as much as they've been approached by the intelligence agencies for whatever reasons that Richard does explain and we will get into, but they've been approached and coerced or convinced to be part of this elaborate street theater.
Blackmail, maybe, or?
That's one of the options. There are numerous options. And with each person, he does give actually an explanation of what he thinks has happened to them.
Wow. There's a lot of pages to fill in that book, right? Yeah.
There's a huge amount in the book, and we're going to go across over as much as we can without boring everyone to tears.
Fair.
So, but according to first-hand witnesses, the Kerslake report is incorrect. Shosek stewards diverted concertgoers away from the foyer before the bang, not after the bang. So what the Kerslake report says is that after the bomb went off, the duty manager actually made sure that everybody stayed away and they stopped the general public from seeing the carnage. But what witnesses say is that they were diverted away from the foyer before the bang. And so Richard points out that this is a slight discrepancy, that if it was fake, that would be a way to control the area. And again, which is fair.
They don't even need to be in or not. They could just be told, do not let people get into this area at a certain time. It's totally,
precisely.
And you don't want everyone in on it. You want as few people who can fuck this up as possible. That's easy. That's very plausible. I mean, to be fair.
Isn't it? Just so, see, this is the thing. So, like, you know, like, I think to be fair, Richard is right. People need to look at his evidence and appraise it fairly. And we will.
Yeah.
So he next goes on to a chap called Nick Bickerstaff. Now, Nick Bickerstaff, in the book, Richard describes this as one of the most humorous parts of the Manchester bombing, because he doesn't believe this man. What happened is Nick Bickerstaff arrived to pick up his daughter, Ellen, and he arrived just before the bomb went off, according to the official narrative, and he saw the carnage in the foyer. And so what happened was he thought he was going to die, and so he got his phone out because he thought there might be a second bomb and started filming himself in case he died, is the official story, so that they would be able to find his phone and realize that he was looking for his daughter. And he pushes past the security, gets into the walkway around the arena, and he's wandering around screaming for his daughter, Ellen. And he's describing what he's seen. He said that
people are laughing and they don't know what's behind me. People bashed into bits and half their bodies are everywhere.
And he squeals because he's obviously in distress. And he's actually being mocked by lots of people who are wandering around. They're just like, they're taking the piss out of him, basically. Now, Richard says, concertgoers in the background seem calm
and are not rushing for the exits. He is the only person who is panicking, and people can be heard mimicking him. His video shows no evidence of a bomb having gone off, no smoke, and no evidence of injured people.
And Richard says that he thinks that this was actually filmed before the bang went off, possibly even before the concert happened, but then it's going to be later framed by the powers that be in order to make it look like. Although he then does sort of change his mind, because he says that the footage shows that there's a girl with a pink balloon in the background, and these pink balloons were dropped into the audience 20 minutes before the end of the show. So he says this was probably filmed about 15 minutes before the end of the show, so still before the actual bomb. Now, he has further evidence to support this idea that Nick Bickerstaff was there before the bomb. UK critical thinker is the bloke that he sort of did this in conjunction with. He spots a bloke called Jordan Kenny. Jordan Kenny actually filmed the crowd rushing. You can go on his Twitter. It's still there to this day. Just after the bomb, he's up in the sort of like high up in the thing, and everyone, the crowd goes rushing. Latterly, Jordan Kenny apparently is doing rather well on OnlyFans. So, you know, big up, large up yourself on that. But anyway, he's in the crowd behind Nick Bickerstaff, and he was supposedly there with a friend called Laura. Now, what UK critical thinker and Richard have said is, in the footage, two things. One, Jordan Kenny seems to be alone, so he's not with this girl, Laura. Two, he seems to be reaching into his pocket and walking past Nick Bickerstaff to the bar, the drinks concession stand, which is behind him. Okay. And Richard and UK Critical Thinker say, well, why is he reaching into his pocket, obviously to get his money, and going to the bar to get a drink if a bomb's just gone off? That proves that the bomb hasn't gone off yet and that obviously he's lying. Now, Richard points out that the bar's behind him. He's presumably reaching for his wallet. That shows that Nick Bickerstaff is lying and that this happened before the actual bomb went off. Now, Richard also says,
in the final sequence, Bickerstaff stands next to the bar underneath a TV screen. The concourse screens usually display a live feed showing the concert inside the arena ball. Although it is not perfectly clear, it looks like the video screen above Bickerstaff's head is showing the Ariana concert. If this is the case, then Bickerstaff's video was filmed before the bang because the bang occurred after the concert had finished.
And it's certainly true that there is a video, a TV with something happening above Nick Bickerstaff's head. So again, this is all building the picture in Richard's mind that this is evidently a hoax. It's fake. It's there to sort of bolster the mainstream official story. And Richard also says that Bickerstaff doesn't seem like he's concerned. He doesn't look like a concerned parent looking for his child. And he makes the good point that why doesn't he phone his daughter rather than film himself walking around looking for his daughter?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Why doesn't he phone his daughter to see if she's safe? Which is a good question. But Richard then just basically goes all out. He says that Bickerstaff is a crisis actor and his description of a bomb shows that he had foreknowledge of the plot, which again shows that the entire thing is a hoax.
And that concludes part one. Thank you for listening to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy, the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. Tune in next week for part two. And as always, if you subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/somedarecallitconspiracy, you can listen to the full 8-part series right now. Thanks again.